BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, the multi-talented Michael Palin, actor, writer, producer and TV globetrotter, has been keeping a diary for decades, and they make for fascinating reading and indeed listening. All this week here on 4 Extra, we're going to hear about the Monty Python years of the 1970s, starting with the making of the first Python film in the Michael Palin Diaries, The Python Years.
I've kept a diary, more or less continuously, since April 1969. I was 25 years old then, married for 3 years, and with a six-month-old son. I'd been writing comedy with Terry Jones since leaving university in 1965, and in addition to contributing material to The Frost Report, Marty Feldman, The Two Ronnies, we'd written and performed 2 series of Do Not Adjust Your Set and 6 episodes of The Complete and Utter History of Britain. After the last one went out in early 1969, John Cleese rang me. "Well, you won't be doing any more of those," he predicted, accurately as it turned out. "So why don't we think of something new?" So it was that, quite coincidentally, Monty Python came into my life only a month or so after the diary. I had, for the first time in years, some free time on my hands. I bought a Ryman's reporter's notepad, smoothed down the front page, wrote the day's date across the top and underlined it. And I've been doing the same thing most mornings of my life for the past 37 years. There are times when I've resented the whole process, but the longer I've kept the diary, the more inconceivable it has been to abandon it. The attraction of a diary lies in its very limitations. It seals the present moment and preserves it from the tidying process of context, perspective, analysis and balance. It becomes history, but quite unselfconsciously. It is an antidote to hindsight. What proves to be important over a long period is not always what a diarist will identify at the time. For the historian's sake, I should probably have noted every detail of the birth of Monty Python. How could I miss the creation of the Spanish Inquisition and silly walks? But it seemed far more important to me to record the emergence of my new family than the faltering steps of a comedy series that would probably last no more than 2 years. And that, I feel, is as it should be. Legends are not created by diaries, but they can be destroyed by them. Tuesday, April the 30th, 1974. Ballahoolish, Scotland. First day of filming on Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Woken at 6:45, sunshine streaming through the curtains. Into chain mail and Red Cross tabard. A difficult day today, the Bridge of Death scene, where Eric and I die and Lancelot is arrested by the police. Dangerous too, from what I hear. Difficult decision over Galahad's blonde wig. Instead of noble and youthful, I look like I should be serving in a supermarket. End of Galahad as a blonde. Such is the economy on this film that not only do the actors have a minibus rather than cars to go to the location, they also have to drive it. John, Lancelot, and I, Galahad, drive up through Glencoe in a renter van in full chain mail. Scrambled up to the Gorge of Eternal Peril. This took about 15 minutes of hard climbing. Camera broke midway through first shot. The day is hastily rearranged, and from having been busy but organised, it's now busy and disorganised. Graham as King Arthur got vertigo and couldn't go across the bridge. He spent the day rather unhappily cold and shaking. Eric, John and I sat around listening to stories from the Mountain Rescue Boys about how many people perish on these spectacular mountains each year. 5 or 6 deaths, usually. Back at hotel at 8:30 for large bells and a bath. Couldn't really face the 4-course meal, so sat in the bar with Eric, drinking scotch and watching card tricks. Wednesday, May the 1st. Eric and I are not needed on set, so we sit in the quiet, well-kept garden beside the hotel, thinking we're rather like officers at the Craig Lockhart Hospital, sitting waiting to recover before being sent back to the front. Eric says he's Sassoon, and I'm Wilfred Owen, who apparently had a bit of a stocky body. At about 3:30, the call comes. Sir Robin and Sir Lancelot drive up to Glencoe, complete with a message from the budget-watching producer to say we must stop by 6 o'clock. At about 6 o'clock, we're hanging onto the ledge above the gorge, waiting for a long shot of the Bridge of Death. Then suddenly, huge mortar blasts send scorching barrels of fire high into the air. The grass and trees are burning. John Standin races across the bridge with suicidal courage, only to be told to get back again as the camera can't see anything through the smoke. I think we may have a few more days of difficulty before the film gets together. Thursday, May the 2nd. Graham is getting shit poured all over him. He's taking a great deal of punishment in these first few days of filming. Wonderful chaos round about 4 o'clock. Out on the island, the motorboat which drove the wondrous ship in which Arthur and Bedivere reached the castle broke down, and Terry Jones was left drifting across Loch Leven with the radio communication set. Terry Gilliam, in great Errol Flynn style, leapt into another dinghy, pushed it out with a Hemingway flourish, but failed to make the engine work, and was also left drifting about 20 yards out to sea. The whole scene was great entertainment value and cheered everyone up enormously. Saturday, May the 4th, Killin. More good rushes in the evening. The boat that takes them across to the castle looks really magical. It'll give the film just the right kind of atmosphere and build-up to make the non-ending work. Sunday, May the 5th. 31 years old. A birthday on the road again. At 11:30, a knock on the door. It was Neil Innes, an honorary python, complete with a birthday present. 3 ducks, a yo-yo, and a junior doctor's kit. Monday, May the 6th. I'm not required in the afternoon, so go back to the hotel. Rang home and spoke to Tom, who burst into tears, and all I could hear was his sad pleas that he wanted his daddy back home. Quite disconcerting, and left me feeling very depressed. John Cleese and I sat on the rocks on the falls of Killin and talked about life. I sympathised quite a lot with his urge to be free of the obligations and responsibilities of the Python group. The basic factor in the future life of Python is that John has had enough of Python TV shows. He doesn't enjoy writing or performing them. The thought of doing any more makes his stomach tighten. He is the oldest and has done more TV, 26 Frost Reports, before any of us really started performing. So he's ahead of us in the disillusionment stakes and will not commit himself to any more Python work after this film. But he was very enjoyable company. John and I talked about psychoanalysis. John's going to a new man, who he reckons has changed him greatly. Told John to try harder to do things which he enjoyed, not to accept work he didn't enjoy. Thursday, May the 9th. Doune. This was the second day on the castle anthrax scene. Doune Castle's severe granite halls are now filled with about 20 girls in diaphanous white gowns, shivering against the cold. John, Eric and I are sitting on an old bench in the great hall, singing Adam Faith and Cliff Richard hits in a desperate attempt to combat boredom. The bathing scene takes 2 hours to set up, the girls giggle a lot, and generally it's about as sexy as a British Legion parade. Monday, May the 13th. The day of the mud eater. Clad in rags, crawling through filthy mud repeatedly and doggedly. Extras all supposed to have plague, boils and pustules everywhere. People really do look wretched, and after 2 hours wallowing in the mud, because the plague village is such a convincing set, reality becomes fantasy and fantasy becomes reality. At the end of the day, I have to eat mud. A mixture of currants, chocolate instant whip, pieces of fruitcake and cocoa is poured out onto a patch of soil, with which it is identical. That night at dinner, the menu began with various effluents. Mud cocktail, fillet of sole a la slime. I was presented with a bowl of mud, which I dutifully tasted. It turned out to be solid cooking fat, coated with chocolate. The mud eater seems to have passed into the folklore of the film. Monday, May the 20th. Strange, surreal moment. A wooden cutout of Camelot, which stood on the top of the hill and looked utterly three-dimensional and realistic, suddenly blew away. 12 o'clock, midnight. While soaking in my bath, I hear a distant shout. I'm going to bed, but I don't necessarily have to go to bed alone. It's Dr. Chapman. He repeats the line 3 times, like someone selling scrap iron, and it recedes along the corridor. Friday, May the 24th. A very heavy week for me. I don't feel quite on top of the performances. Something tightens up inside me during a take. The relaxation and control of a rehearsal is lost. Mind you, filming is an appalling process for reducing an actor to the role of machine. In The Knights of Ni, for instance, I was to do close-ups first. Directly in front of me is a group of Anorak crew squatting down, far more preoccupied with their equipment than with me. Someone reads the lines off in a flat voice, which gives you little encouragement. An eyeline keeps you looking at no one at all. Then you're about to start and the sound isn't right. Then the sun comes out and the camera has to be adjusted. And during this, so much of one's spontaneity and relaxation just drain away. Monday, May the 27th. Helen and the children come up from London. Helen, who's probably pregnant again, is feeling worse in the evening than the morning. The boys stayed up to watch the rushes and see their dad in a lot of strange guises. Rather pleased to share with Helen and the kids the silly things I've been doing over the last 4 weeks. Tuesday, May the 28th. A rather fraught morning. Today we're to shoot the encounter with the three-headed knight. Graham, Terry and I huddle into the cab of the cameravan to learn the words, a magazine of film sticking into my back. A battered little jackdaw, which the crew had rescued, lay beside me in its box. I wasn't enjoying myself at all, and Graham couldn't get it right. Finally, we're strapped into our three-headed knight costume. All my apprehensions about it were unfulfilled. Graham, with just a little prompting, was very funny, and Terry, who was also directing, was the only one who seemed to be physically suffering in the uncomfortable costume. Thursday, May the 30th. My eldest son Tom came down to the location and was quite impressed to see my now rather shabby Galahad gear, especially the sword. He and Willie played with the other kids on the mound leading up to the castle. Finally called to do the opening sequence of the film. Usual difficulty with swirling mist as it was a totally unmisty day, but beautiful views from the castle battlements. I'll long remember standing up on those cardboard reinforced battlements with John, looking round on a view that can't have changed much since Doon Castle was built. Tomorrow is the last day of filming. Already an end-of-term atmosphere. Friday, May the 31st. Today the long and wordy constitutional peasant scene. Feel heavy, dull, and uninspired. Somehow it takes a supreme effort to get the words and the character together. We do the scene in one long master shot and, thank God, we get through it first time without a hitch. Ideally would have liked another take, but there's not enough time or enough film. Willie and Helen arrive midway through the afternoon. Willie's a little apprehensive of me at first, what with sores on the face, a shock of red hair, blackened teeth and rags. But he stays long enough for doughnuts and milk at tea. I'm almost too tired to enjoy fully the elation at the end of the day, when the filming is finally completed. Want to leap up and down, but can't. So I just stand there, looking out over the Scottish hills, all grey and dusky and hazy as evening falls, and feel wonderfully free. It's 32 days after we'd first clung to the side of the gorge of eternal peril.
Michael Palin reading his diaries charting the Python years. It was abridged by Loris Morgan Griffiths and the producer was Louise Armitage. Tomorrow he looks back at February the 22nd, 1975, the day that Python died.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello there, Joanna Pinnock at 3 o'clock with your drama. To Carlingford next, a town which needs a new MP, and Lucilla is determined to help find him in Margaret Oliphant's tale of the forthright Miss Marshbanks. And talking of forthright misses, Mel's here at 4, exploring the wonderful world of mushrooms and introducing the first of this week's stories by Hans Christian Andersen. The Little Mermaid, that's all in an hour. So now, in the final part of the Carlingford Chronicles, Miss Marshbanks is worrying that she might have gone off.
The Carlingford Chronicles by Margaret Oliphant. Miss Marshbanks, dramatised in four parts by Elizabeth Proud, with Elizabeth Spriggs as Mrs. Oliphant, Teresa Gallagher as Miss Lucilla Marshbanks, Keith Drinkle as Mr. Cavendish, Christopher Scott as Mr. Ashburton, and Roy Hanlon as the Doctor. Episode 4. The Battle Lost and Won.
The very day after Archdeacon Beverley's wedding to Mrs. Mortimer, Mr. Cavendish left to spend the winter in Italy.
It has long been a dream of mine.
He made very brief and formal adieus to Lucilla, to the extreme amazement of all the surrounding world. And then disappeared.
Well!
Leaving a wonderful blank behind him. Lucilla felt it acutely.
The most popular man in Carlingford. Gone! And the worst of it is, I am universally blamed for his departure.
He went away to escape having to propose to Lucilla.
No. I believe that Lucilla refused him.
Lucilla sent him packing to get him out of the clutches of Barbara Lake, if you ask me.
Oh.
It was with this last impression that Rose Lake made her way through the autumn leaves to see if any explanation was to be got from Miss Marshbanks.
You have behaved a little strange, Lucilla. If he cared for Barbara and she cared for him, you had no right to come and take him away.
My dear, I did not take him away. I had to talk to him about some business, that was all.
And what right had you to come and drag us to your great parties? You made Barbara come and sing and put things into her head. It is all your fault.
I don't know why you should all turn against me like this. I do all I can for my friends, and they are never pleased. And when anything goes wrong, it is always my fault.
Perhaps if you were not to do so much... Well, never mind. I am ashamed to ask you, but do you know where Mr. Cavendish is, Lucilla? She is breaking her heart because he has gone away.
Did he never go to say goodbye nor anything?
No.
He has gone to Italy. But he will come back, and I suppose she can wait.
Oh, Lucilla, it is as good as putting an end to my career. And just after my designs have been so successful, I won a prize, you know, in an exhibition in Kensington. And I shall have to give up everything, and I can't help feeling it, Lucilla.
Tell me what is the matter, and perhaps we can do something.
She has made up her mind and advertised in the Times. And nothing can change it now. She is going out for a governess, Lucilla.
Going for a... what?
For a governess, with no objections to travel.
She is a selfish thing. She always was. I should like to know what she can teach anybody. I would not give in to her. Why should she stop your career?
Why? Because there is nobody else to do anything, Lucilla. The twins are so little, and they're all the boys to think of, and poor Papa. But I am quite happy. Well, it is her heart, you know. It is only my career.
It was thus, amid universal demolition, that Miss Marshbanks ended the first portion of her career. Ten years passed, and the period arrived at which Lucilla had thought she might perhaps have begun to go off in her looks.
And when most people have husbands.
By this time, the drawing-room carpets and curtains had faded a little, and nobody could have thought that to marry now would be in the least degree to swindle the doctor. Thus, the moment had arrived to which she looked forward.
But the man has not arrived with it.
Unless he might happen to be... a Mr. Ashburton, who was related to Sir John and Lady Richmond.
A family much respected in the county.
Oh, yes. Mr. Ashburton has become quite an asset to our society ever since he came to live at the Firs.
A legal man, very able.
Yes, everybody knows everything about him. Not like that fella Cavendish.
Oh, as if anybody remembered Mr. Cavendish. And then occurred an event which had been long expected.
Dead?
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 Dead? Dead. Mr. Chilton.
Yes, poor dear old man.
For my part, I wonder he's lived so long.
Yes, 10 years ago, you know, his death was looked for every day.
It will mean an election.
Election?
Election?
Election? Election?
Oh, Mr. Ashburton, is it you?
Oh.
My mind was quite